This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
2 years ago, cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or Ethereum was essentially a tech geek topic. Now it's becoming increasingly something that mainstream investors care about. Since January 1, the value of a single Bitcoin has gone up more than 800%, and the total market cap of all cryptocurrencies is up 1,300%. Just as a point of comparison, the stock market over the same point is up about 17 or 18%. So you can see the difference between 18% and 800% is pretty appealing.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. That audio comes to us from Fortune Magazine. Bitcoin is all the rage, and our friend Peter Grandich has plenty to say about that, plenty to say about investment and markets. You're definitely going to want to take part in this and definitely going to want to give us a call if you've got questions. He earned the nickname the Wall Street Whiz Kid for correctly forecasting many of the major bull and bear markets in a nearly four-decade career on Wall Street, having made and lost millions not once but twice, and having endured battles with severe depression that left him lost and hopeless. Peter Grandich found his Catholic faith at rock bottom and has since been on a crusade to tie faith and finance and what he says is the only true way to handle one's finances. In recent market commentaries, he has used the word petrified to describe what he sees as having already stated as America has entered into what he believes is its worst ever social, political, and economic era. Peter, welcome back. Always great to talk to you, my friend.
Same here, Ed. Always an honor to speak with you, my friend.
And I know that this is radio, so you don't get a chance to see it, but every once in a while, Peter drops in on my podcast. I get a chance to see his massive credibility bookshelf. He's a great commenter no matter where you're at, and always gives it to you straight, which is something that you don't always get when you're talking about economic analysis in today's markets.
Well, I appreciate that, Ed, but if you saw me now, I'm lying on a couch with my back out, but so you wouldn't see the bookcase if we were doing the Zoom.
No, that's true. It's true. And I you know, we're all praying that your back feels better. I've been there, my friend. I have thrown my back out on many occasions, and it is no fun whatsoever. So thank you very much for sticking it out and showing up here today. You just heard this thing from Fortune Magazine about Bitcoin. I just saw something go by my news feeder here about being able to do Bitcoin by ATM. I mean, this is really going mainstream, and I bet you couldn't find 2% of the people who could actually tell you what Bitcoin is.
Well, I think the good news from my perspective is cryptocurrencies are here to stay. There's no question that we're moving into a digital currency age. I suspect that all the major countries, I know the United States, China is in the forefront, is going to see that. Whether or not Bitcoin remains something more than an extreme novel and mania-type play, I don't want to call it an investment. It hasn't been around long enough. You know, it has about 13-year history, and people are already saying it's replacing something that has a couple thousand-year history, meaning gold. But no question that anybody that's been fortunate enough, just like that fortunate enough to have caught a hot stock for a while, or a hot market, has done really well. I think the only question now is, from $58,000 or so, are we going to see these incredible numbers that are tossed out by so-called mainstream people of, you know, 500,000, a million? And that's not uncommon. And the only thing I always say to that is, I've been at this almost 40 years, and back in the 80s through the 90s, they were throwing people out of the penny stock brokerage industry for suggesting stocks could go up that much percentage-wise. So I think that there's a time for caution and concern, and if you've done real well in that market, congratulations. But going forward, which is really the only thing that's going to matter, and the hubris and the overconfidence and the mob-like mentality that if you even dare speak not in favor of it, all comes into play at mania tops, and that's another concern that I would have, not just with Bitcoin, but the overall market in general.
You know, Peter, and by the way, you can find out more about Peter's work at petergrandage.com. I don't think we mentioned that, but petergrandage.com is where you can find out more about his work. You can also read his book online at petergrandage.com. He makes it available there, so if you want to find out about his life story, it's a great place to go. If you want to call and ask questions, it's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You know, I was reading something, and I think it was either earlier today or it was late yesterday, about penny stocks and about how a lot of the a lot of the market motion we're seeing is somewhat reminiscent, just as you just said, about how the penny stock market has operated in the past. And I have been wondering about that myself. With, you see this in stories about, you know, for instance, GameStop, where online speculators really run up the price of GameStop, which isn't a penny stock. I don't mean to imply that it is, but it was sort of somewhat similar treatment or somewhat similar dynamics of what happened with that and some of the other, a couple of the other stocks that were targeted by these sort of online clubs. And that gives me a little bit of pause about the stability and the reliability of these markets. I mean, do you see this as a big issue, and has that, is this becoming mainstream now to be doing these types of things?
I think the first thing that one needs to take a step back and look at and try to understand is that what existed when I entered the brokerage business back in 1984, what we call the stock market, and what we call a stock market today is radically different. Back then, about 90% of the daily trading, which was really confined to the New York Stock Exchange, and we had one other basic exchange called the American Stock Exchange at the time, 90% of the trading was by the public, and most of the people who were buying and selling were treating it as part ownerships of businesses and hoping that a product or a service or some sort of thing that that company provides would grow in revenues and sales and profitability, and therefore their part ownership value would go up and somebody else would come along and want to pay more for their part ownership and go down the road that way. That is basically almost non-existent, just like the New York Stock Exchange, which you may see on a certain network in the background, is really more of a museum. Almost all the volume now that trades in markets are done in off exchanges, not that exchange. Now, we really have the market broken down in this regard, Ed. About half the money now that exists is in what we call passive investing or passive funds. It's in index funds where people are trying just to track an index, and therefore the manager of that fund is not actively buying and selling individual stocks based on stories or fundamentals in the markets, but only when it has to keep a comparison to whatever index that they're tied to. The remaining half is almost now split among different types of computer trading programs, where it's either algo traders that have computers set up to trade and buy and sell based on news stories or words in news stories, and the others are quantitative analysts that have all sorts of different types of programs, gamma, things like that nature, where they're buying futures and selling stocks or options all simultaneously. That individual buyer who are wanting to own part owner of a company is very limited now. So one of the first things for someone like myself that's, you know, getting on 40 years in this is to understand that the market, when we call it the stock market, is nothing like it was back then. So therefore, if you're still using fundamental analysis from that period, you're really using outdated. And I like to simply put it, Ed, that we've gone from a stock market to really a high-tech casino hybrid of a stock market, and it's being driven by things and factors that really had no basis 20 or 30 years ago.
And I think that that's maybe my generation has the most difficulty wrapping our minds around that, because, you know, it was my generation really like sort of entered the stock market in a large way. Maybe my generation, maybe just, you know, the band just before that. The stock market used to be more or less, really there was an investor class that was a small percentage of the American public, and most of the rest of Americans had, you know, pensions directly from employers. You know, they had pension funds that were set up from employers, and that's how they set the retirements up, then that plus Social Security. But tax changes in the, I think, early 1980s, maybe a couple of them in the late 1970s, really did expand the investor class to be passively or actively most of the United States. And so I think we thought we were getting into the old stock market. I'm not sure that the rest of us have actually caught up to that. When you're talking with people who are looking for investment advice, do you find that to be one of the toughest things that, to try to explain to them?
Well, part of it now, of course, as what you bring up, the big change was the 401k, as you said, taking it away from defined pension plans and things of that nature to where people were, in a sense, self-controlling their own destiny of where, you know, with guidance, where they were to go. I find that most people, individuals, are using the markets as a secondary way if they're business owners, if they're real estate investors. The market tends not to be their primary source. Where the primary source for the market is people that, you know, are day-to-day, paycheck to paycheck, trying to put a little money away using the 401ks, they're more inclined to be more dependent on the market. But where a lot of people who at one time didn't pay attention to it are, in a sense, being dragged into it because of the extent of how much it's in our day-to-day news, and realistically how much the powers that be, especially the Fed, have made the market almost the economic indicator that judges of whether or not we're doing well. And that's been the big problem, especially even before the pandemic, but through the pandemic. We've had about somewhere between 1 and 10% of the public do really well during the pandemic, mostly because they are heavily invested in the stock market. And the stock market was one of the few places that did really, really well. And then the remaining 90% or so people either held their own, slipped, or fell hard because they lost their jobs, their businesses closed, et cetera. So the spread or the difference between the 10%, Ed, and the 90% has never been greater. And only one of three things can really happen if you just look at it simplistically, and that is either the 90% start to make up and catch up to the 10%, the 10% fall back to the 90%, or more likely somewhere in between they're going to meet. And that's what we're facing at a time, as you said it when you read my introduction, where I really think America as a whole has never been worse off combined socially, politically, and economically. And so it really concerns me that we have a market that's priced for perfection. We have an abundance of hubris and complacency I've never witnessed in my 37 years at this level. And we have a lot of issues socially, politically, and economically that are all, or partly all of them, could interfere and end that market, you know, continuing up. And so I really just think, you know, and as I've said, as you said, is I've come to the point where I'm in a sense petrified, and even in the last couple weeks have told people for my personal self that I am raising a lot of cash. I think what had been a very poor choice to do for a lot of years, cash, is now going to become important, because if I'm correct that sometime between the next 6 months to 12 to no more than 24 months that we have another serious decline, this country is not in a position, Ed, to deal with it that it was able to do in the last few financial crises. The 2000, which was mainly a dot-com bust, and the 2008, which was mainly a mortgage real estate-related bust. Now we're in an everything bubble, and the problem is if we have another financial crisis, for whatever reason that it comes out of, there's no political will anymore, Ed, for the groups to sit down and somehow try to solve that financial crisis at a time when we're indebted beyond imagination. We're going to hit $30 trillion in actual hard debt, not even counting Social Security and Medicare, and where we have a clear shift to the left in America at a time where still the people that own a lot of the assets are in the middle to the right. So there's a whole bunch of things that we can go on, Ed. But like I said, I just think it's better to be a live chicken versus a dead duck going forward.
So this is, I mean, I need to, we're talking with Peter Grandage at petergrandage.com, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. And you mentioned the word petrified at the current situation. And I'm hearing from what you're saying here now is that you're really recommending that that people be leery about the long-term prospects of investments in either stocks or bonds. I mean, is that sort of kind of where you're going with that?
Yeah. So the bonds last fall, I never had been bearish on bonds. And last fall, I says that's it. I mean, we were down to, you know, less than 1% on yields. We already knew inflation was a lot higher than that. And when I literally noted to people that still wanted to listen that there was a double-digit potential loss in bonds, it was just unheard of. That you can imagine losing double digits investing what used to be fixed income market, which the Fed helped to destroy by, you know, doing what they've done with interest rates. But we saw so many people chasing yield to the point that they were getting into exotic type of yielding products in order to try to maintain a lifestyle that they grew accustomed to. And that's, we've now seen in the last, since then, the second worst period in bonds in 40 years. And that wasn't supposed to happen. That's why you went to that market. You weren't supposed to be looking at double-digit losses and all. So there's a lot of issues here, Ed. And if I may, before we run out of time, the biggest concern now in the last couple of weeks has been the rise in so-called interest rates. I mean, before the pandemic, the long bond was above 2%. So even if it got back to that, one wouldn't normally be concerned. But where the real concern comes in and where people have to take some real serious consideration, and I don't see the professional community doing this either. Listen, before we had the pandemic in 2019, we had one of the best years ever economically. Trump's reason, whatever it was, it happened. We took in about $3.5 trillion in tax revenue. That's what America lives off of. We paid about $440 billion in interest, just interest, on the debt we currently own. So let's just say there is a mean reversal and interest rates go back to what many feel would be a more normal range. 4 or 5% was not a very high interest rate not too long ago. In fact, they used to pay you a lot more in a bank and give you a toaster if you gave them the money. But let's just say we go back to 4 or 5%. Well, if you look at that $30 trillion, which is hard debt, and put a 5% interest on it, we would have to pay $1.5 trillion, or almost 50% of the revenue that we took in our best years, before we even start about paying our defense and everything else that we have to pay in America. That's the real issue that the Federal Reserve faces and the government faces. And why there'll be a desperation, if they're not already there, to not want to see interest rates rise a lot, because then we have a real serious problem here in America that our neighbors and all the people that help fund the world's largest debtor country will see and realize, and then that's where the real, real issues can come from. And this is something that's been building. It's not something that I first started talking about and some others, but we're really starting to see people now of real serious mean recognizing that that's a legitimate issue facing us, and how do we go forward that through that during a period where socially and politically we've never been more divided as a country.
We've got some great calls on the board here. Let's go to Carlo in Chicago, who's got a great question for you, Peter. Carlo, welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. Just a quick question. You've mentioned cash, and I've heard advertisements for the war on cash. It's some kind of publication or something. Do you know anything about that? Or
I'm going to take a guess that it means more of that we're going to see a cashless society, that everything is going to be digital. I don't think it's a war on the, you know, I'm guessing that's what it could be. We are moving more to a digital currency. I expect that we'll see in 5 or 10 years most countries using that, and the actual hard cash itself, what I'm speaking above, in lieu of being fully invested, which a lot of people still find themselves in, and having no spare cash to act if and when I'm correct and there is a downfall and assets become much cheaper, you want to be in a position then to actually take advantage of that. And that's what I'm talking about, building up more cash.
All right, Carlo, thank you for your call. Let's go to Lisa next in Texas. Lisa, welcome to the conversation.
Hi. My grandfather taught us rather carefully, being a young man during the Depression, that stock investing is dangerous because you're lending money to someone you don't know who doesn't have to pay you back. And I was wondering if you had some wisdom on that.
Great question, Lisa. And your grandfather sounds like a wise man. Peter, what's your reaction to that?
Well, what's interesting, over time, we tell this in our planning group. We tell people that if you look at where most people have made money at, they've either made it, they first inherited because someone else made it earlier on in the family. They made it by being in small or mid-sized business owners. They made it in commercial real estate. The only time when the stock market more times than not comes in, either they worked in financial securities and made money being an advisor, or they were mid to large manager at a public company and got granted a lot of options. To this day, I can still count on no more than both my hands the amount of people I met and said, oh, mom and dad put $5,000-$10,000 in the market every year and walked away with $2.5 million. You know, if you could control your own destiny and influence versus turning it over and investing in people where you're totally dependent on what they do, I think normally or not, you'd rather have control over your own destiny. However, because of what we've created and how much money that we've put out there, we've now, look, Ed, we just saw that they took polls of what people are going to do with the latest money that's being given out, and almost half said they're going to invest it and buy Bitcoin and stocks and things of that nature, when they really should be concentrating because we're helping them because you're supposed to need, you know, food and shelter. So we've really gone full circle, Ed. You know, Business Week ran a famous front page in the early 80s saying equities are dead. We never thought we were going to see the market go up again, and now the market has become almost a way of life for a lot of people. So I think she brings out concern, at least, is that maybe we've gone too far and counted too much on the market to continue, and we need to look at alternatives.
Lisa, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Elva in Watsonville, California. Elva, welcome to the show.
Hello. I have a question. I'm 52 years old. I have a 401k, $200,000 invested. I wonder how can I go ahead and keep it from being used, like for Planned Parenthood, or invested in something that, where can I invest that money, or what can I do in order to keep that from being invested in something that's, you know, us Catholics don't believe in?
That's a great question.
Well, there are, I can't tell you which ones, but there are funds particularly out there for Catholics and also Christian-type funds that supposedly, and you have to count on that the managers will keep what their prospectus says and not invest in places like that. That's the only thing I can suggest to you. I really can't name any of the specific ones, but I'm certainly, if you do a search that says Catholic mutual funds, you'll certainly see some names pop up.
So, Elva, that's a great piece of advice. You can take a look at that. Peter Grandage, you can find out more about Peter's advice at petergrandage.com. He's also on Twitter, at Peter Grandage, so you can find his valuable insights linked there as well. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Did you ever tell someone you'd pray for them? Now's your chance. Hi, this is Father Rocky with our 27th lesson on the Mass. After directing her prayers of offering to God the Father through Jesus Christ, the priest prays for the Church, the Pope, the local bishop, and all who holding to the truth hand on the Catholic and Apostolic faith. And then he says, Memento, which is Latin for remember. Remember, Lord, your servants, N. At this point, the priest and all the people pause to pray in silence for a few moments. What do they pray for? Actually, the question is, who do they pray for? They pray for N, with the N signifying the first letter of the Latin word nomen, which means name. The moment's arrived to pray for people and for their needs, because the Mass is first of all an opportunity for prayer of petition. Who do you pray for at Mass? You have been joining me for Lenten Lessons on the Mass. Now I'd like to invite you to join me for Mass itself at noon Central.
And join us for Class After Mass. It's The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio.
I need warriors. I'm building an alliance to defend ourselves.
How do you know your team's strong enough?
You were sent here for a reason.
And even if it takes you the rest of your life, find out what that reason is.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 31 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. It's Friday! It's a Friday afternoon, and we're heading into the weekend. And as always on Fridays, I love just taking a look at the entertainment that may be on tap this weekend, as well as entertainment issues in general. And there's no better person to speak to about that than Christian Toto, a film critic who started out at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, moved on to the Washington Times, and then when he saw the real leftward lurch that Hollywood was going in, he started his own website featuring his own reviews called Hollywood and Toto. You can find that at hollywoodandtoto.com. He's on Twitter at hollywoodandtoto. And Christian, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Christian, the Snyder Cut. Now, that's what we just heard the audio from, the Justice League slash Snyder Cut. And let me tell you something. My Twitter feed is agog with the Snyder Cut. I have a couple of colleagues who are agog with the Snyder Cut. Everybody's talking about the Snyder Cut. What the heck is a Snyder Cut?
Okay. It does sound kind of odd. Okay, here's the backstory. Zack Snyder is a pretty popular director. I'm not a huge fan, but people seem to like him a lot. He was set to direct Justice League. It's like the Avengers, but with the DC Comics heroes like Batman and right. Superman a couple years ago. And then he suffered a personal tragedy. He had to step away from the movie. Now, I imagine he was pretty deep into the production, but at that point, they decided to hire someone else to finish the movie. And that was Joss Whedon, another talented director. So the movie came out. It felt a little bit like a Frankenstein's monster of different pieces and parts. And you can kind of guess why. Didn't make as much money as it should have, didn't get the critical love it should have. And then ever since then, the fans were like, we need to see the Zack Snyder cut. There's enough material there to make a movie, or we want to see his vision. And again, this is Comic-Con. This is sort of the nerd nation, and I consider myself a part of that nation because I'm kind of a nerd myself. So that's what it was. And because we are living in a Comic-Con nation and because we can, you know, have our voices be heard, enough people rose up and said, we want this movie, where Zack Snyder and Warner Brothers and all the powers that be said, okay, we're going to put it together. So what they did was they used the existing footage, they shot some new footage, they kind of pieced it all together, and now we've got this four-hour presentation.
A four-hour movie of Batman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Superman, and... Yeah, see, I'm not a big, huge comic book movie although fan, but I understand why they are attractive. I do. It's just not my thing. I, on the other hand, sat through three and three quarter hour presentations of Lord of the Rings, and in fact, I did a marathon of all three director's cuts as soon as they were out on DVD. So I have no room to talk, Christian. I mean, I have absolutely no room to talk. And anybody who I put through that, my family members and friends that I invited over to sit through 12 and a half hours of Lord of the Rings, or about 12 hours of Lord of the Rings, will tell you that I have no room to talk about this. So, but 4 hours, I mean, is it worth it to sit through 4 hours of Justice League?
You know, technically, no, in that, a movie of this kind should not be 4 hours, period. I love these movies. This is, you know, in my wheelhouse. It shouldn't be that long. And actually, you can really see where there are moments that could have been cut. The storyline itself is very simplistic, and they often will explain it, then over-explain it, then dwell on it. I'm thinking, okay, guys and gals, we can cut this down. We don't need that. But I also think, in a way, this whole project exists for the fans. These are the people who are clamoring for this vision. And if you're going to make a big, bloated movie that's really kind of a testament to that fan passion, then I guess 4 hours is okay. So, I mean, it's not for the casual viewer. I would like to see a trimmed-down version. I think that would be excellent because the movie has some very wonderful parts. But overall, you know, it's, again, you love Lord of the Rings movies, so you're willing to kind of punish yourself and your immediate family members by doing that. And if you love these kind of movies, you will sit through 4 hours. And to be fair, I watched it mostly in one pulp, and it moves pretty quickly. There is some bloat for sure, but I wasn't bored, and every time I got a little bored, it ramped up again. So it's not watching My Dinner with Andre for 4 hours. It's a rock'em sock'em popcorn movie.
So it's not The Irishman, is what you're telling me. The Irishman was about 4 hours long, wasn't it? I think I did actually sit all the way through that when that came out. That was about a year ago, I think. It was near the beginning of the pandemic, I think, or maybe even just before the pandemic.
And that's too long too.
Yeah, I mean it's too long, and there's these moments where you're going, did we really need this part in the movie? Is this really a big issue? And certain types of entertainment, certain types of stories do need to be told in a longer format, right? But then what you do is usually you separate them into two or three installments. You turn them into on cable television, you turn it into a limited run series, 3, 4, 5 episodes, or in movie theaters, you do, you know, Justice League Part 1, Justice League Part 2. And the rival to this, of course, the Marvel Universe, they actually end up doing that with their big Avengers series, which, you know, they really kind of broke up into two or three movies and made a huge amount of money doing that, too.
Yeah, I mean, but this is a movie that is debuting specifically on HBO Max. So I agree with what you just said, but it is better suited for a small screen in a way. And yet at the same time, it's a big blockbuster movie, so you want it on the big screen. So it's a little bit of an odd mix. But, you know, you and I are critical. I think I'm more critical than even you are about Hollywood, how it is often dismissive of audiences, certainly, flyover country, as they dismissively call it, or people of faith when it comes to audiences. This movie really does exist for the fans, and I like that. I think that's it's a very kind of populist feel. And again, if you're not a big superhero fan, you see 4 hours, you run for the hills. You don't want any part of this, nor should you watch it. It's not meant for you. It's a very specific kind of film. I think it's good. I think it's better than the original version, which again was sort of pieced together. It didn't really have room to breathe. And it's also something that needs to be trimmed down in a perfect world.
And I think that's a great point. I mean, it's for the fans, and that's really what you want to have in terms of entertainment. Now, if you're talking about art, it's a little bit different. They overlap, but they're not exactly the same thing. They have different aims. But for entertainment, you really do. You want to hear from the fans, and you want to give the fans what they want. And in this case, they you can watch either one of these, as you can with many director's cuts. They'll do a director's cut. I think the most famous director's cut was probably Blade Runner, which actually got released in the theater. I think it was maybe the first of the director's cuts that it was sort of pioneered that, if I remember correctly. And I found that to be a superior film than the theatrical release, even though I like both of them. You can see either one of them, but it does. It gives the fans an opportunity. Now, when we're talking about art, it's a little bit different, because art, you want to make sure that the art is true to the artist's vision, and it's not necessarily for the fans. And that brings me to the next topic today, Christian, which is the Academy Award nominations. You know, it's been a while since I've been really into the Oscars, but usually I've seen a couple of the films. Usually I've heard of them all. This year, I think there's 7 nominees for Best Film. I've heard of 3. I have seen exactly 0 of them. And I mean, they're all accessible online, so it shouldn't be that difficult to come across these things. But man, did the Oscars get obscure this year. I mean, you have to ask yourself who this is for. It's certainly not for the fans, right? It's certainly not for the average movie-going public. That's a trend that's been coming on for some time, but this year really seems almost like a quantum leap forward in obscurity.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a tough topic, because I don't want the Oscars to be about the movie that made the most money, necessarily.
Right, and that's a great point. That's a great point, Christian, absolutely.
Yeah, because sometimes movies that make a lot of money, I don't think they're great. I mean, they sort of scratch a certain itch, and people like them to a certain degree, but I don't think that represents the best movie of the year. But having said that, you do want a dollop of populism, a sense that the stories you're telling have a somewhat of a broad appeal, where they're not just sort of micro-niche geared. And I feel like that's where we're headed. And, you know, I don't want to fully blame Hollywood this year because the pandemic has sort of changed everything. And, you know, there may have been some mainstream type films that just were held back because they weren't, you know, because the theater shut down. They thought it wasn't the right time. But I think we are heading in a direction where it's going to get more and more like this. I don't think this is a complete aberration. And what's interesting is because of streaming and all that's going on in the world right now, I think we have a better chance of seeing all these films than ever before. Because often it's like, okay, it's in L.A., it's in New York, it's still in theaters, I don't have it near me. Well, a lot of the stuff is on Netflix or Hulu or all the different streamers, and it's still obscure. And you're still, you as a movie fan are still like, what was this again? So it's a problem. And when you see the ratings for this year's Oscars, wow, it's going to be another falling off the cliff moment, I think, because I don't think anyone's really involved or interested.
This is, and we're speaking with Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Hollywoodandtoto.com, by the way, is where you can find Christian's work. And this is sort of my point, right? I mean, there's really no connection here to even a broad audience. And it's not as though award shows are on the upswing. I mean, the Golden Globes had their worst performance ever in the middle of a pandemic when there's not a whole lot of other entertainment options. I mean, people are at home. They're in front of the television set. And people, was it Samuel Goldwyn who's credited with the idea of, if they want to stay away in droves, you can't stop them or something like that? You know,
it's very strange that in a year of pandemic life, and not only just with the award shows, but even some sports have been really cratering in the ratings.
Yes.
And I think part of it is that there's a lot of messaging going on within the sports community and within the entertainment realm that doesn't really connect with half the public. And I think that the powers that be don't care. Because if you're an Oscar producer or an Emmys producer or a Grammys producer, and you don't realize that what you're doing is offending half the country or at least putting them off, then you have to, have your head in the sand. I mean, I can't understand it, but that's part of the problem. But I touched upon this. I wrote a story today at my site. You know, the woke culture that we're living in is just really killing these award shows. And it isn't just the ratings. If you watch the shows, they're not fun. They're not engaging. They're not lighthearted. They're not celebratory. They're not interesting. And they're not funny. Because that isn't the goal anymore. It's about lectures. It's about wagging your finger. It's about righting all sorts of societal wrongs. And that isn't enjoyable. You know, if there's no black members of the Golden Globes community, that's potentially a problem. Let's look into it and let's solve it. But let's not use the night's big event to lecture the audience because, you know, it's not their fault. It's not our fault. It's your fault. And I'd rather see you fix it than have us being lectured about it. I mean, it's just not the right time. You should put on a show that celebrates the arts and then fix the problems behind the scenes.
I think that that's an issue that Hollywood may actually be waking up to. I don't know if you saw the story with Ralph Fiennes in the Telegraph about J.K. Rowling and about cancel culture and its vitriol and the danger it has to free expression. But I mean, you're sort of getting, how many different awards are in award season, right? In a dozen or so. And they all kind of look and sound the same because they're all talking about the same subject. And really it's not anything that's engaging with the audience. And when I look at this thing with the Oscar nominations, that to me is the first thing it says. This disconnect is almost complete now. This disconnect has been coming for some time, for 20 years or so. It's almost complete now. These awards shows are really just for the people who are in the room, and that's it.
Yeah, and you think that if you're a young person, and let's say maybe you like to, tinker with the piano, or you've got a violin, or you've got some sort of musical instrument, you'd want to watch the Grammys, and maybe you'd say, oh gosh, I'd like to be like that performer or this performer. I'd like to kind of aspire to that. And then you watch the show, and you've got Cardi B, putting on a performance that's darn near pornographic, and your parents are going to kick you out of the room, hopefully, if there's that on there. What's the point of that? I mean, at some point, these award shows are meant to elevate the arts, to embrace the arts, to celebrate greatness, and also to kind of invite us in. And they're not doing that.
Right. We're going to talk about the entertainment options coming up this weekend with Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto, so stick around. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're talking with Christian Toto of HollywoodandToto.com, and we're going to talk now about the entertainment options for this weekend. And normally when we would do this pre-pandemic, it would be, well, what's opening at the theaters this week? We don't get a chance to do that, but, things are opening online, and things are opening in some of the streaming services, and so we can at least do that. What's coming up that we should avoid? What's coming up that's good?
A couple quick things. One, on Disney Plus, there's a new, sticking with the superhero theme, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier debuts this weekend. It is, of course, Anthony Mackie as the Falcon and Sebastian Stan as the Winter Soldier. It's sort of pinned as like a kind of a buddy superhero romp, but though in the first episode, which I've been able to see, you don't get them together quite yet. But it's, I believe, 6 episodes, and boy, it looks like a Marvel movie. It's got the big blockbuster special effects, and it's got that cinematic feel. So if you like all the Marvel movies, you'll enjoy this. I think it's kind of a work in progress. I didn't feel very compelled by some elements of it, but good actors, and if you've got the superhero bugs, I think that's going to work for you. I just want to draw attention to Hulu. They've got a couple of interesting films. One that's getting a lot of Oscar nomination buzz is called Nomadland with Frances McDormand.
I've heard of this. Yeah.
It's good. It's a woman who has lost her job. She's recently been widowed, and she ends up, for a lot of different reasons, just traveling the country as a nomad. Basically, there's kind of a group of people who live out of their vans. They travel from place to place. They kind of live off the land. They're kind of very resourceful. They're kind of almost like unplugging from society in a way. And it's pretty fascinating. She's a great actress, and she's wonderful here. So I'd recommend that one. And also, there's a movie that came out a few months ago. It's called Dear Comrades. It's based on a true historical event in the Soviet Union in the early 1960s. And it really made into an excellent film. So that one's on Hulu as well. And it doesn't really pull any punches about the Soviet style of government and how repressive and how freedom-snuffing it is. And the fact that it's based on true events makes it more interesting. So if you're looking for something a little bit more gravitas, I'd recommend that one.
That's interesting. Any particular stars of that, or is that pretty much that's on Hulu, right?
Yeah, I didn't recognize anyone. It's a foreign film, and I kind of saw it a little while ago, so I'm blanking on the specifics of the characters and actors, but it's definitely worth your time. And, Hulu's got some more obscure titles. Some of it's junk, some of it's very good, but, a lot of times what we're seeing now is sort of niche, more obscure stuff, and I don't dismiss any of it, but... if you're looking for it, that's where you can find it.
Well, if you're looking for one of the benefits of the closing of the theaters, at least in the short term, is that it sort of makes the new entries a little bit more equal, right? Not totally equal, mm-hmm. because if Disney's putting something out, you're going to hear about it a lot. But there is a little bit more equality of access to this. And depending on which streaming services or subscription services you have, there's a little bit more ability to access these things. You mentioned it earlier, a lot of films would normally play in art houses. You can now everybody can have it on their television screens as soon as it's released. And so you can find some gems that way.
I agree. I don't want to mess this one up because it's by a friend of mine. There's a new movie. It's out on Amazon right now. You can pay for it maybe $4 for rental. It's called The Healing Garden. It's a faith-based movie about an army chaplain who is really struggling in life. He lost his wife. He's moved into this new smaller community that's kind of hardscrabble. And it was made on the literal shoestring. But you know what? It's got a lot of strong spiritual elements in it. It's got some great performances. The two main characters, one is the chaplain, one's a little girl who's just a terrific young actress. And, you know, it's the kind of movie that, even though the budget isn't what you think it should be, will move you. Well, you'll kind of enjoy it in a way that you maybe don't see very often. And also, you know, I think a lot of faith-based films feel, even the best, feel a little bit cookie-cuttery, where maybe you kind of know which beats are going to happen next. And it just gets, you know, it's formula. I mean, movies are formulaic, and that's nothing wrong with that. But this one, it's got a little bit of an indie vibe to it, where the jokes are a little bit different and fun, and it's got a genuineness to it, if that's the right word, that I enjoyed as well. So it's called The Healing Garden, available now. I think it'll be coming out soon on DVD, but I think you can tap into it immediately on Amazon streaming service.
We are speaking with Christian Toto of HollywoodandToto.com. You can find him on Twitter at HollywoodandToto. I'll tell you one that I saw that I'll warn people off from. Okay.
And it's, I like this.
And I was really disappointed because I really like the people who were in it. The cast was really good. It's an Amazon movie called I Care a Lot. And it's supposed to be a dark comedy, right, about a woman who is exploiting seniors, and she picks on the wrong woman to exploit. And you expect this to be sort of a comeuppance film, which it kind of starts to be, but then it shifts. There's some really woke elements in this to where all of a sudden you're supposed to be rooting for her. Peter Dinklage is in this. Rosamund Pike is in this. And I really like Rosamund Pike. I really like Peter Dinklage. They do great work. And they do great work in this movie, but it's not in service to anything that really makes a lot of moral sense. It doesn't make a lot of narrative sense. And it has just these elements that just play against each other. It's not even like counterintuitive in a good way. It's counterintuitive in, I don't understand what it is that you set out to do with this film. You had a great concept, and then it just gets wasted, and the talent in here gets wasted as well. I don't know if you've had a chance to see that, but I would say if you don't want to watch, I Care a Lot. Unfortunately, we really didn't care a lot for this film.
That one, you know, I started to, and then I kind of got lost. I kind of just had a change. I don't know. I didn't get a chance to finish it, so I'm disappointed. I do love the talent there as well, especially Rosamund Pike. She's wonderful. Just a quick question. It's on Netflix. It's a Netflix original. So
I'm sorry, Netflix. You're correct. It was on Netflix. Not Amazon. You're right. It was on Netflix. We were bouncing around trying to find something else. So, yeah.
I think it's very frustrating, and I'm literally writing a book about woke Hollywood right now, but it's not just that maybe woke platitudes don't align with my worldview, and they don't for the most part. I mean, some do. I mean, I certainly want diversity and I want people to have an equal opportunity. But often when it comes to storytelling, it really does hamper what's going on the screen. And that's what can be frustrating, because you want to tell a good story. And if there's maybe a woke message that's kind of built into it, that kind of flows organically, fine, go for it. But when you do it and all of a sudden you as an audience member say, "What? This doesn't really make sense. It's just not working." That's a problem. I think that's what you're really, you know, I suspect that's what you're kind of bumping into with this movie.
It was. And I mean, you kind of keep wanting to watch it just to see if it manages to pull it out of the tailspin, because again, the talent is so good and you really want, you know, I really wanted Rosamund Pike to have a good movie here because I really, really think she's terrific. But yeah, it's not good. It's not good at all. And then I also tried The Stand-In with Drew Barrymore, and we couldn't get past 25 minutes. That one was terrible. It was a terrible movie.
Yikes.
Yeah, that one, I like Drew Barrymore too, but I couldn't last more than 25 minutes. It's terrible. It's a terrible film. So you're writing a book about
price for that one.
What's that?
I hope you didn't pay full price for the Drew Barrymore one. Or was that?
I can neither confirm nor deny. Pay for that. But you know, sometimes you go to the movie theater and you pay your money and you take your chances there too. Speaking of which, we've got maybe about 1 minute left. Do you expect movie theaters to open in large part this year as the vaccines go? You got about 30 seconds to answer this.
I think they will be opening. Whether people are going to be in the theaters, I am really skeptical. I'm really skeptical. I am very pessimistic about the immediate future. I think that something's going to happen from a cultural point of view, maybe a sensational movie that everyone has to see to change things. But boy, I think there's an uphill battle, and I feel badly for the theater owners and the people who work there.
I certainly do as well. Christian Toto, thank you so much for being with us. You can find him at HollywoodandToto.com. Also on Twitter, at HollywoodandToto. Christian Toto is always there. And he's got a book coming up about woke Hollywood. But now stick around, because on the Cale Clark Show, we'll be talking about St. Joseph in Scripture. What does it mean to fear God, and revenge, bedtime procrastination? I am still curious about that. I'm not sure what that's about, but it sounds fascinating. Cale Clark coming up next. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. Have a great weekend.